Ecclesiastes 3:9-15. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before Him. That which has already been, that which is, has already been. That which is to be, already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away.
We're going to be studying in 1 Samuel 9, chapters 1 through 10, verses 1 through 10. So if you'll turn there. Verses 1 through 10. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechoroth, and the son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. And he had a voice choice and a handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to his son Saul, "Please take one of your servants, arise and go and look for the donkeys." So he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the lands of Shalisha, but they did not find him. Then he passed through the land of Shalim, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find him. And when he had come to the land of Zoph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, Come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us." And he said to him, "Look now, there is a city of a man of God, and he is an honorable man, and all that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" And the servant answered Saul again and said, "Look, I have here in hand, 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man to tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, "Come, let us go to the seer." For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. As I was studying this, the Lord directed me in particular to His revelation about Saul being a handsome man. And that's kind of the central focus I want to look at as we look through this passage and examine the idea of physical beauty, and not just in people, but in creation in general. And in the context of the children of Israel and what's happening surrounding all of this passage, what it might mean, why God might be have brought that out to us, is He has a reason why He tells us things. And so we're going to examine that and try to learn a proper perspective on physical beauty and our creation and on spiritual beauty, and what we can learn from that. And we'll take a look, too, toward the end, at how it appears that Saul was not able to see that. He was not able to see God's beauty and spiritual beauty. And he's stuck in the physical realm. Now, in the context here, coming up to this, we learned last week about children of Israel rejecting God. And it manifested itself as that they're looking for a king, an earthly king, to replace God as their king. And they were having a horizontal focus instead of a godly focus. As Ben was talking about and pointing to Romans 1 about this, that's what the natural man does. And it's early in my Christian life, I remember reading stories about the Israelites and was really puzzled and wondering, what's going on with these people? I mean, they're one minute they're serving God, the next minute they're all worshiping idols. And, you know, it was like, but God's right there in front of you, and you're not seeing it. You know, but as I've matured in faith and learned a lot, you know, I realized probably at that time there's a little bit of self-righteousness when I was looking at that. And saying, look at these people, you know, and not realizing. So I was focusing on the people and what they're doing and not focusing on God's purpose. Because men are depraved. We know that in the Bible. And we know what to expect from them. So what is it about this ebb and flow? Well, what's God doing? Because God has a plan and a purpose in everything. This didn't catch God by surprise. Them rejecting Him didn't catch Him by surprise. There's a purpose in it. And one of the things, too, that I think adds a little bit of clarity, maybe that you don't catch, especially a young believer reading this, these contextual clues about some time passing. Right there in chapter 7, God had just given them victory over the Philistines and drove the Philistines out, and they never came back. And they had turned to God and prayed to Him and said, we want God to lead us. Samuel prayed for them, and God gave them victory. Well, you flip the page, and they've rejected God. You know, but there's some clues there that, you know, it says Samuel led, judged Israel. You know, it kind of gave like an ending, and there was a new chapter happening. And then we see his sons came up, and he made his sons judges. Well, right in there, there's a lot of time that probably passed. So that's part of what going on here to help explain how this incredible sea change has happened with the people of Israel. Well, maybe a decade or two has passed, and things are happening. Leaders have died that are helping to point them toward God, and maybe young people come up there that are not part of the remnant there. And so the remnant has waned a little. And so not only has time passed, but we see that probably the remnant has maybe either gone down in influence or gone down in numbers some, but it's not this complete change of people, from people following God to people not following God. Really, it's an outward change. A lot of it is what's happening here. I think that's what's explaining a lot of this ebb and flow in the history of Israel. And this came up last week during lunch. I think Ben was talking about this, about the idea in our culture today. You see a similar thing happening where you see there's a sea change happening in our culture. But is it really so much so that people are falling away from God? We don't believe that happens. We believe God keeps us. And so part of what's happening here is it becomes socially acceptable when the influence of the remnant maybe wanes for whatever in God's purpose. Well, it becomes socially acceptable to reject God in your heart. And outwardly, a lot of people have been following God or giving lip service to God in our culture through the decades. Well, now some of that's coming out, and it's becoming easier because they've got this another social network that they can rely on. They don't have to follow. So they're not ashamed of their rebellion now. People can come out more now in America and express their rebellion. Well, that's what I think probably what's happening a lot in Israel through this time in history is there's a waning, there's an ebb and flow, and there's a waning, and the remnant lose some of their ability to control. Because God, we're salt and light, and the remnant is able to, at times, control the depravity in a society and to suppress it, and we're called to do that. It's to suppress rebellion, and people, even a lot of people outwardly, even in their own minds, they feel they're following God during these times because of the influence of the elect among them. I think it happens in our culture. I think there are a lot of people who, you know, God and country, and they feel sincere in that, but their lives show that that's not really happening. But outwardly, and for our good, God is protecting us by keeping down this influence of rebellion? Well, for his purposes, sometimes that doesn't happen. And there's that ebb and flow. And right here, at this time, it looks like this, in my mind. The remnant may be going up and down some during the time of Israel, but the population's way up here. And they're following God outwardly. As a nation, as a group, they've accepted God. God, help us. Because of the influence of the elect within them, within the culture, then they can feel that this God might help me, help me. So they cry out to Him, and they're accepting Him. Then the remnant loses some of their influence. And if that sea change happened, it could happen over a period of just a few years. And all of a sudden, everybody's rejecting God. Well, it hasn't happened. People's hearts haven't changed. Their hearts are the same. They just now feel more free to express themselves. I think that's what's happening here. And so, in my mind, I'm thinking, what is God teaching us through this? And I think in particular, in the Old Testament times, with the children of Israel, there was a special purpose God has called out the children of Israel for, and that is many ways to teach truths about God. It was a special time. It points towards Christ, and it points towards a lot of things. And I think one thing we can see from this is the depravity of man that we discussed. That's what men do. That's what they're going to do when the restraining influence of godliness is pulled back. That's what men are going to do. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, God is beautiful. We're going to look at that. They couldn't see that. They can't see that. They're following this. The children of Israel as a group, they're following these men. And just that they don't understand the spiritual things. The remnant did. The remnant could see God and see His beauty. But what did they see? They wanted a king. They wanted a man instead of God. They couldn't see God's beauty. They wanted a man. Well, I think it was fitting then that God would give them a handsome man, because that was their mentality at that time in history. They were after the physical. The people had shown their cards, what they were about. And God said, well, I'm going to give you what you want. And He gave them that. Well, as we consider that, I think we can reflect on our own spiritual walk as believers, and we see a similar pattern. We reject God. We do. Now, we don't do it the way they did it. We don't worship false gods. We don't do horrible things, usually. They're really offensive to our sensibilities. No. But we do reject God at times. When we get frustrated about where God's put us, about some little event in our lives, we're rejecting God. And so we have that battle within us. And I want to look at Galatians 5:17. For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. For these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. But if you're led by the Spirit, you are not of the law. So we see that battle happening within our own lives that is sort of a little bit of an analogy when we look at the children of Israel of rejecting God, but then we turn and we repent. And we cry out to God, God, I'm sorry. Forgive me. And God restores us into fellowship. So you have that ebb and flow. But when we're walking in the flesh, we're not able to see that beauty of God, and we can get caught up in worrying about the physical and not putting it into its proper perspective. The physical's there, and it's God's creation, but it's there for a reason. It's to point towards God. That's what the beauty around us is. That's what creation is. And instead of looking at the creation for its own self and for what it can do for us, we look at it and it needs to be pointing to God every time in our lives. And so I wanted to just open the floor a little bit. If anybody has any ideas of maybe some ways in which we could stumble or be tempted and to fall into seeing the physical, especially I'm talking here about the physical attractiveness of not just people, but in things in our lives that may be a temptation. I've listed a few here. Yeah. Of course, physical attractiveness. in people is a big one, and it's the one that's listed here, and it's probably one of the biggest ones that we face. I know, I mean, if you're looking in the mirror and you're saying, this is it, you're it, you know, you're the man, it's a red flag, But you know what? There's a lot of us, we look in the mirror, and we might not be saying that. We might be saying, man, my ears are so big. Oh, what's wrong? There's some flaw, and we get over concerned about those things. They become man-focused instead of looking at God and looking at His beauty. And, yes, sir?
The passage there in Galatians, but if you be led of the Spirit, ye are not under the law. Oftentimes, my spirituality is determined by my ability to keep the law instead of my trust in God. And that would be where I'm looking in the mirror saying, you're doing all right, Ben. So you got this, and this going on. And the reality is I've already strayed from faith in Christ when I start checking off the outward works of the law. There's a note here that says that but if ye are led of the Spirit, ye are not under bondage of effort to please God by law works. Pleasing God by law works, by the works of the law. I please God through faith. Faith coming through from Christ, through grace that He's given to me. So,
absolutely.
Not of myself. It's a gift of God. And so, as I look in the mirror, I should see this worm that has been glorified for God's glory and the work of Christ in me. And that should be where my joy, my pleasure is. Not because I can show everybody how good I am, but because Christ is revealing His greatness, His sufficiency in my ability to keep the law. But not my ability, but His ability through me, which He's given to me. So,
absolutely. That's a good example. Yes. It's one of the most insidious things out there. It's that false religion, turning away from God and seeing this false spiritual beauty in myself. Look at my spiritualness. Yeah, that's a good example. And then there's a lot of this, and I'm trying to admonish and get us to be thinking about this during the week. There's so many things. It's so personal to each person, that your hobbies, things that you like. But I gave a few things that are kind of like biggies that we all have, our looks and our home and our cars. Those are kind of like, in our culture, those are big things, in America that can draw us away. You get caught up in having exactly the right paint scheme and on and on and on. And, which there's nothing wrong with any of that, but you might be a time to pause and reflect. Say, am I overemphasizing this thing? Am I wanting to say something about myself? And am I focusing on myself and what people are going to think about me when they're walking in my home? Or am I doing this under God's glory? And related to the home, the front lawn. Oh, the front lawn is a big one. Some people are obsessed, and I've heard stories of people who they can't lay their head on their pillow at night if there's a dandelion that's popped up in that turf of grass. No. And that checkerboard pattern. Got to have that check when you cut the grass. Got to have that checkerboard pattern right there. It's got to, And of course, that one's, that's an easy one for me to pick on, because the Wygants can tell you I don't suffer from that temptation at all. They're back there going, amen. That's even with me. But again, if somebody's doing that, if you're out there, if you're doing that unto the Lord, you've got this beautiful landscape lawn to the Lord. That's great, Anything like that that's important in our lives, just red flag, check your heart, see what your purpose is and where your focus is, where you're looking, where you're wanting that to direct people when they see it. All right, we're going to look at, and I'd like everybody to turn to this one, Chronicles 16. You don't have to turn to all these passages, but this is kind of one of the central ones for today I wanted to look at. First Chronicles. 16:28-30. Give to the Lord, O families of the peoples, give to the Lord glory and strength. Give to the Lord glory due His name. Bring an offering and come before Him. O worship the Lord in beauty and holiness. That is the fundamental truth of our faith, that God is beautiful. His holiness is beautiful. That's what makes God beautiful, is His character. God is holy. God is perfect. God is all good. He's all powerful, all knowing. He is the focus of our attention and what we need to be looking at, His beauty. Now that is, you know, in one sense, that's a very simple truth, and it's not a deep truth. But at the same time, it's something that we're learning about all through our lives, something that we're seeing more of and learning the deeper truths of it. John 10:27, Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice. They know me and they follow me." Early on in the believer's walk, when God is calling us, that's one of the very first things that we see and realize. We hear this sound. We see the light. And it's beautiful. We don't know much about it. We're just little babies, but wow, it's beautiful, and we hear. And we hear that voice and we follow, because we're attracted and we're drawn to the spiritual beauty of God. He begins to reveal Himself to us. John 3:21 says, "But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen that they have been done in God." And that's what we did right from the beginning. Those of us who've been believers for a while can remember back. Some of you new believers remember, wow, who is this wonderful God? I want to know more about Him. And you go out into the light, and you're not afraid of it anymore. You're not hiding in darkness. Well, it also says here, that His deeds may be clearly seen. We are participating in God's beauty. He allows us to participate. God says we're the light of the world. How can that be when we're so ugly? Well, we have the righteous robes of Christ. That's it. And we go out into the world and we participate in God's beauty. And He is seen through us as believers. We have the robes of Christ and we have the Holy Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit operating in our lives, revealing God to the world. And first and foremost, it's by the preaching of the gospel, by living out our faith. In 1 Corinthians 13, verses 11 through 12. You don't have to turn there, but if you're already close by. 11 and 12. "When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I'm known." So, Paul's using an analogy here of the growth of a person in the physical realm to our growth spiritually. And I think, maybe this is misunderstood a little bit, I don't think that we become men in this world. I think we become men when we see Him face to face, is what he's talking about. We're still children right now. We are still putting away childish things. And that's what we're here today doing. And that's what we're trying to learn more how to do. And some of those childish things are those things that capture our attention with our eyes. Things that are beautiful that we get drawn away from for their intended purpose. The intended purpose is to reflect back to God. Those things are only temporary, and they're meant to reflect the glory of God, the glory and the beauty of His brightness, of His holiness. And back to what I was talking about, we start off as babies in this analogy. We don't know much at all. Well, now we're children. Some of us are older children. There's different levels that God has placed us in our spiritual walk. But we're all seeking that day. We're seeking the day when we see God face to face. And we see the brightness of His glory. We see His beauty in its completeness and its totalness. And I don't think we can handle it right now. I don't think that we're able right now. God is attuning our spiritual eyes, getting us ready to see Him face to face. And so part of that is God's means of grace in looking at these things and saying, you know what do I need to be looking for in my life, the examples that we've looked at previously. In Isaiah 53, verses 2 and 3, says, He shall grow up before him a tender plant and a root out of dry ground. He has no form of comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised, he is rejected by men, man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. It certainly appears to be saying that Jesus Christ was not a pretty man, that he was possibly pretty ordinary. We don't really know for sure, but he was not beautiful. It says that right there. Well, why is it then that these things, beauty in the world, points towards God? Why is it that we have these the types, like the linen ephod that we discussed before, intricately made beautiful? And it was a representation of Christ. Why is that when Christ wasn't beautiful? Well, the answer is what we've been talking about God's spiritual beauty, about beauty of His character, the beauty of His holiness that we need to be searching for. And it comes home in Hebrews 1:1-3. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son, whom He has appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the worlds, who, being the brightness of His glory and the express image of His person, and upholding all things by the word of His power, when He had by Himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Jesus Christ is the image of God. He is the brightness of His glory. That is why the beauty of this world points to Him, because it's a reflection of God. God's creation is a reflection of the true beauty, the everlasting beauty. Okay, so I wanted to look briefly about characteristics of beauty, because in today's age, postmodernism, people want to subjectify everything. Everything's subjective. Nothing's real. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. That's the end of the day, you know, in today's, a lot of people's thinking, a lot of modern philosophers, because they've rejected God. Well, I don't think that's true. I think, and to a large degree, beauty is an eye of the beholder, because God's made us each individually different with different preferences. But there are some fundamentals in nature that point to God that are objective. And I listed a few things like symmetry and balance and texture, form, that are measurable. And they're an expression of God's creation. And You can even measure it mathematically. You can look at things like a sphere, a globe that we see, you know, in the heavenlies out there a lot. When we see that, we're drawn to it. We know something. There's something special about a globe as opposed to an oddball shape, you know. Well, the reason we're drawn to that is because it's an image of God's perfection. It's showing some perfection. And the closer you can get to that perfection, the more it compels us. We realize there's something to that. Well, when we research that in mathematics, we see that it can be grafted mathematically. Well, that's because there's an underpinning creator who's created it, and he upholds all things, and he has form and he has beauty. Well, it's expressed in creation in a lot of ways. And one other example I want to bring out is in music, because that same thing's true of music. Can anybody know list anything about music that's objective?
Rhythm.
Yeah, rhythm. Rhythm's one of them, that's right. That rhythm can be measured. And, you know, we all have different tastes. There's all kind of tastes in music. So there is that subjective element of each of us, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, you know. But there's a common underlying theme in music in its measurability and its rhythm and pace and dissonance that can be measured with scientific instruments. And it has to do with the frequency of sound, the physics underlying sound. God is there upholding that physics. Well, the reason it sounds good is because when you have these waves, sound waves, well, different waves can match each other mathematically in ratios. And that's what music's about. It's about those ratios, 2-to-1 ratio, 3-to-1 ratio. When they match perfectly, that's a harmony. That's what we hear when you hear people singing. It sounds real beautiful because those waves are matching. Well, God is in those waves. He has created sound. He's created all the physical universe. So that's the way we can measure God and see objectively that there's beauty that and harmony in God's creation. And one other thing I wanted to look at about this, we're going to move down into the text a little, but I wanted to touch on this because as we're talking about God's beauty, there's this question, and I think it is a serious question in the modern church. It's a question of the ugliness, of sin, of darkness. And the modern church, quite often, has come to the conclusion, probably even the majority of Christians, that, well, since there's this ugliness here, that the ugliness wasn't part of God's plan. It couldn't have been. It is ugly, and God's beautiful, and, well, that would make His plan ugly. And so they've rejected God's sovereignty over all things and are not really seeing God for who He is in His totalness and His completeness. That God is sovereign. That is my belief. I believe that's what the Scriptures are teaching us. And it's a reality, and it can be a difficult truth. That God holds the heart of man in His hand. He moves it like the rivers of water. God is in utter and complete control. And this all of this is part of His plan to glorify His Son. And that's first and foremost why I believe that. But also, it's a logical fallacy to think this way. It's the composition fallacy. It says that the properties of the parts are also properties of the whole. They transfer to the whole. Or vice versa. And that can be easily seen to be fallacious. You look at a car, for example, a sports car. A sports car is fast. That has a property of being fast. The part is not fast. It is only in the whole, in the completeness, that can make something more than the sum of its parts. It develops properties that the part doesn't have. And probably a closer analogy would be a flower. We had that analogy in the Bible. And God talks about the lily of the field, and they're beautiful. Well, you could imagine a flower, bright and beautiful, and have these little speckles of darkness in there. Well, they enhance the color of the flower, and the color is just spectacular. It's beautiful. Well, look at it under a microscope, but really closely. You might find out those speckles, well, they're ugly. Get it? But it's part of that flower. But the flower itself becomes beautiful. And it adds to it. And God's plan is perfect. He has a plan. He has a reason for sin. He hates sin. Don't get me wrong. Some people will come to the conclusion, well, it's part of his pain. It must be good. No, God hates sin. God will judge sin. God's wrath is poured out on sin. But that's part of the beauty of his plan to reveal himself and his character. And that's what's happening. We want to see that. We want to see that God is powerful. God can use these things. And it's hard to see. It is. I've struggled with that myself. We're up close. We're seeing that ugly spot. We're up close right in here. And a lot of things affect us, and it hurts us, you know, and may question God. What is about this ugliness, God? And it's confusing. And it is. But that's part of God's plan. It's part of his revealing of himself. And it's something that we're going to see. Like we talked about earlier, when we get face to face with God, we're going to be able to step back. And we're going to see his plan in all its beauty that we can't quite see right now, because it's difficult for us to comprehend. God's revealing it a little at a time. He's revealing his beauty to us. So the challenge today is, you know, to be aware, to be looking, and to see that this beauty that we see in our lawn or the things that we've talked about, well, that's nothing. I mean, you can enjoy it for God's creation, but it's pointing to something else, something huge. All right, now we're going to move along the text a little bit and notice here in a minute that we see Saul, he's not getting this. He's not getting God's beauty. That's what it appears to me is what has happened. We're going to read chapter 9, 3 through 5. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost, and Kish said to his son Saul, please take one of the servants with you and arise and go and look for the donkeys. So he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Cilicia, but they did not find him. And then he passed through the land of Shalem, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find him. And when he had come to the land of Zoph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us. All right, so we can take some application from this in that, first of all, we see that Saul is outwardly obeying his father, and that's a good thing. So there's an application for us. And I think, too, that in this time, in this arena, Saul is also acting in a capacity as an employer, in a way, in his family farm. And that, unlike in today's world where we have a lot of division of labor, back then it was farming. And some of those farmers, if you happen to be the son of the farmer, you were also kind of like an employee, and he guided you in that way. So we can take a little application in trying to be obedient to superiors and wives, to husbands, and with wisdom, and also with Kish, giving out reasonable commands and, you know, determining the effort. Do we need to take the effort to look for these? Is it worth our time, you know, to make a reasonable request of our children, of our wives, our employers? Be wise in your dealings with employees. I had a time years ago when I first started work, and my employer, I heard about this from some people talking about a meeting they had, and he was not happy. And he said, I invented the wheel, you just roll it. So that told me something about my employer, that I need to be rolling the wheel, you know. And so I tried to do that as best I could because of my an employer relationship. There's a temporariness to that. There's an agreement there. I can walk away from that anytime I want to. It's not like a marriage. It's not like father-son. But it's still, as long as I'm committed to that, as long as I'm on that clock and I've agreed to this agreement, I'm to do my best to follow orders, to accomplish the mission of the company, to provide a good product in a safe way, in an efficient way. And in general, that is to be accomplished by following orders from your supervisor. I don't think it's a hard, fast rule, though. There's give and take there. Sometimes things, they tell you the wrong thing, and the actual company itself wants you to do a good job, not just blindly follow your employer, because I ignored him early on and I got bit by it. And things didn't turn out well at all. I got chastised. Felt like there was a possibility I was going to lose my job early on in that. And I got a pretty good boss. He was patient with me. And I continued to ignore him sometimes, but it started turning out well. And that's the thing we need to consider. Do we think that we know something? Do we just have this good idea? We need to defer to people who have more knowledge. And just like he deferred to his dad in this situation. Unless we know, we've been through this over and over, and we know. I started going through things in my work over and over, and I knew my boss was wrong, because he's up there at the strategic level. I'm down here, in the trenches, so to speak. So I knew that he was wrong, and I just did it my way, and it started turning out good after I had learned my craft. And then I see my boss begins over time. Now he doesn't micromanage me so much, because he's growing too as an employer, and he's a pretty wise employer. So he's picking up on the fact that I know, what I'm doing, and he's bothering me less about it, which is good. Yeah. But most of the time, and we have to have that attitude. It's probably true. Most of the time our superior knows what they're doing, usually when he tells me something's right, So we need to respect that authority, and we need to respect our parents and honor our parents. And another application we can take from this, we see Saul, he counts the cost. He pauses here in verse 5, I believe. He's counting the cost. What do y'all see the cost he's counting? Can y'all recognize it? That's right. He's counting the cost of the peace of mind of his dad. The situation changes over time. It's a dynamic situation here. It starts off, his dad, he's not worried at all. Sends his son out. As time goes on, things become more unusual. If the time is more unusual than normal, and it apparently is here, he starts saying, well, my dad's, this the value of those donkeys starts going down. And the value of your loved ones starts to go up. You start to realize that. And then you'd be aware of that the whole time. And that, not just in that, in our relationships, but you count the cost physically and economically. You look at those, what economists call opportunity costs. You weigh that. You don't just blindly go looking for donkeys, and stay gone a month. You look at all the money you've given away if you do that. Other animals have lost. Things have gone to chaos. So count the cost. You'd be reasonable in these things. That's an application we can take to that. And outwardly, Saul seems to be like he's concerned, and so he's being a good example, at least outwardly, in that aspect of it. And, he's sent on a journey. He's sent on something for something that's lost, and we have all lost things. And I know probably some of you are like me, and you occasionally lose your keys, or we might lose a pet, and we have to go search for it, and God might turn us in a different direction. At the end of that search, we may find our whole lives turned upside down like Saul's was here. He is led in this direction so that he can be proclaimed king. Spoiler alert there. He's king. He becomes king. But look, he certainly wasn't expecting that to happen. So that things like that can happen in our lives. If we're looking for God, we're looking for him in every little thing we're doing. If we're going looking for that pet, we knock on somebody's door, that could be God. He could be turning us and holding it. Be ready for what God brings to you. I know I have spent some major time looking for my wallet. You say amen to that. She's over here thinking that. Oh, yeah. But I've gone around the house, so many times. I probably went as far as Saul here, in his journey. Round circle in the house looking at all my spots. It's not there. Not there. And what is it about that? I got this box. And I keep my several more things I carry to work in it. Well, it ends up getting other things thrown in there, And so it's a mess. So my wallet's not in there. I go looking. I come back. And this time, I'm like, I got to be efficient. I've wasted my time. I'm looking again in this same box. Take out everything slowly. I take it out. I'm looking out. I'm staring at it. I look in the box. The box is empty. There's no doubt this box is empty. I see every item. It's impossible that this wallet's in here. Put it all back in. Go around the house. Come back again. Don't look in that box. I'm telling myself, do not look in that box. It's impossible to look in that box. I don't know. Rabbit trail alert. But I don't know. That's not really related to this, but somebody help me with that. That's another sermon. I don't know. All right. Getting back on focus here. So, at the risk of over-spiritualizing, we can look at our spiritual journey. When we look at this little journey that Saul was sent on, and realize that God has He's given us a mission to go out for the lost sheep. That we are ministers of reconciliation, He tells us. We're out here sent out to the world to reconcile. Well, God's means of reconciling His people to Himself, finding the lost sheep. So we're on a journey. We're on a journey looking for lost. And God will not lose a single one of those, we're told. He will accomplish His purpose, and we get to be a part of that purpose in our spiritual journey. And we're going to look on down into the text. This last section is verses 6 through 10. And we're going to see, this is where we see that Saul appears. This is my understanding of what's happening here. He appears to be missing it. Missing God, missing God's beauty. And he said to him, "Now look now, there is in the city a man of God. He is an honorable man, and all that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." And then Saul said to his servant, "But look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring the man of God. What do we have?" And the servant answered Saul and said, "Look, I have here one fourth shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God. Tell us our way." And formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, "Come, let us go see the seer," for he was now called a prophet. He was formerly called a seer. And Saul went to his servant, said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. Okay, you know, what I'm taking from this is that Saul has this great opportunity right here. And he's still focused on the donkeys. And rather than saying, you know, in effect, you know, he was about to decide to turn and go home. Right? So instead of saying, you know what, this is a lost cause, but hey, we're close to the city where the man of God is. Let's go find out. Let's go find some spiritual knowledge. Let's go ask him about the scriptures. Let's ask him about our purpose. We're a special people, God is telling us. What does that mean? We're gonna be a light to the world, a blessing. Whole world's gonna be blessed because of us. Why is that? It could be picking Samuel's brain about this, or lots of other things, and learn about what does it talk about the seed, this particular way that God's going to bless the world. He could have been asking those questions, but what he wants to ask, where's my donkeys? You know, that he's going to the city to ask an incredible man of God like this, has this reputation, where are my donkeys? Point me to my donkeys. What a waste, what a focus on straight ahead, on the horizontal instead of focusing towards God and towards His beauty. I might not want to be too hard on him. We go to God for trivial things all the time, don't we? We ask Him for little things. Where are my keys? You know, I've prayed that. So it's not necessarily that He's asking Him that. It's that there's no relationship. This is a rare opportunity He has. He doesn't get to see, and that's the only thing on His mind. So I'm seeing that He's missing God in this. That he is focused on the beauty of perhaps his fortune, his material gain, if he can find the donkeys. You know, he's going to the palm reader, and here's $10. You know, he's treating Samuel that way. Tell me my fortune. You know, how can I get rich quick? You know, that kind of thing. So he's missing it. And so lastly, you know, just an application of the role of spiritual leaders in our lives. And Samuel was a spiritual leader of his people. And then we need to take advantage of that and use that for God's intended purpose. And that our spiritual leaders, if they're our parents, our elders, just mature believers around us, that we can learn from them, we can go to them, and primarily as examples of servant leaders. Learn from that, but also learn the scriptures, sharpen iron together, go to those who are wiser than us, who've had more experience, and to learn from them. And in doing that, we learn how to see God, learn how to see His beauty and everything around us.